This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're back with a big interview. We're looking at 2015, 2016 and picking out some of the best bits and clumsily gluing them together. EvoStick sponsors this show. You'll all have your opinions on how our guests would rank in terms of football ability, in their prime particularly. I happen to think that we've talked to some who are Hall of Famers in any company or during any era, but occasionally a name comes up that causes them to draw breath. This collection is dedicated to those parts of the conversation when we get to talking about one of the all-time greats, sometimes with someone who's got a unique angle from which to examine those special talents. So, on Leo Messi, we've had Gary Neville. And it's his job to find new or refreshing ways to describe what it is this little Argentinian genius does. Gary, I can call him a genius here, can't I? Graeme Souness, certainly one of the best players of his generation and in my all-time 11, plus Peter Beardsley, have got things to say about Messi themselves. We'll put a video of the warm-up routine that so enchanted Peter on our blog, which is at grahamhunter.tv. Have a look at it. Paul Clement worked closely with Cristiano Ronaldo during his successful time with Carlo Ancelotti at Real Madrid, and Paul gives us insight into that unsurpassed work ethic which has elevated Ronaldo above almost everybody else. He'll also tell us about the lighter side of his personality. It's a good anecdote, I promise you. Harry Redknapp remembers the development and then the graduation of Gareth Bale into an international superstar. The mighty Darren Fletcher, easily the nicest man in the world, gives us a timely assessment of Wayne Rooney's contribution to a succession of Manchester United teams. Henke Larsson is better than all of them, at least in the eyes of Kevin Bridges. And Danny McGrain might just top the list for Charlie Nicholas, who benefited from Danny's generosity as a man, as well as his huge influence as a teammate. Unfortunately, not many of us listening were lucky enough to see John Charles play football live, but Joe Jordan followed the trail that Welshman blazed from English football to Italy, and Joe tells us about the gentle giant's impeccable reputation in that ultra-demanding football country.
The amount of players I get heard called geniuses. He's magic, he's a genius.
Yeah.
He's a magician. No, he's not. There's nowhere to go from there. There's nowhere to go from genius. There's nowhere to go from magician. There's nowhere to go from... You know, these words leave you no room for... So I watched Messi play against Manchester City in the Nou Camp, and I was genuinely, for the first time, I think, in my football career... I can think of maybe Ronaldo a couple of times at United where I was watching injured in 2007-08 where I was probably similarly mesmerised. But I was genuinely, as a broadcaster, the only time I've ever watched a performance where I've been genuinely mesmerised by a player was Messi for the 20 minutes before half-time in the Nou Camp against Manchester City. I was like, and I've seen him before, and I've seen him on the television, and you know, I've seen him live many times as you have. But I was genuinely thinking, this is as good as it's ever going to be. Yeah. This is... I'm happy to use, I call it a scandalous, it's scandalous talent. It's out of this world. And people on social media will tell you, well, oh, you're bullying him up to it. You cannot go, that's the point where I just thought, I have to go for it. But it's the only time. But once you've used that for him, everything else is below that. Everything else, every word, you know, you can't again go and call, you know, with respect, watching a player at Burnley Tottenham last week, you can't go and call him scandalous talent or a genius, because you've called Messi that. So I always like to think where I pitch things is relative generally through, and that's difficult. It is difficult to get that right, I think.
Well, why do we humans like boxing? Why do we like contact sports? Why, you know, the richest prize in sport was a boxing, it's fighting. You know, why do we like that? Because we like see young men test their physical strength against another young man, their mental strength against another young man. Football's no different. I think a lot of people from my generation, not players, would say they enjoyed the football then far more than they do now.
I feel that it's more bloodless. We see more of Leo Messi now than we could have done in your day, because of his size, simply because he is so small.
He's all there, isn't he?
Oh, no, and the rest.
I mean, you know, he's solid.
Yeah.
I think, you know, my thoughts on Messi, I think Messi's the best player that's ever kicked a ball. Mm-hmm. And I think he would have been if he had played in my generation or before my time.
He could have done these things then.
Yeah. Yep.
It's funny, I was talking to one of our coaches yesterday, because when we train, and obviously a ball will go somewhere, I almost become a ball boy, just naturally, not in a negative way. And then we'll have a clump of balls where we're feeding from, and I might be 50 yards away, and I will always ping the ball back from where I am, or the side volley. So I pick it up and I volley it, and it sounds bigger. 9 times out of 10, it'll go where it goes. And people are like, they look at you like they're surprised, but it's practice. Mm-hmm. It really, that's as simple as that, you know. And I keep telling them, you know, not because of me, but practice. And I talk about Messi all the time. He doesn't get that because he doesn't want to practice. He looks as though he wants to play football. I saw him in the Champions League final, Graham. You ever saw him at Wembley when they beat Man United? Mm-hmm. I saw him and Dani Alves about 40 yards apart, volleying the ball, keeping it up, volleying it back. Wow, it was one of the most pleasurable things I've ever seen on a football field. And that was just warming up.
Let's take an example, two examples, two superb free-kick takers. How much would Cristiano practice his free-kicks, and how much would there ever have been a limit if he wanted to do half of it? How much did Gareth practice his free kicks, or is the modern player so in control of the ball that they don't need to practice their ball taking?
I know they practiced almost without fail before a game. The day before a game, they would be 15 to 20 minutes of central free kicks. Sergio Ramos would be in that group. So, yeah, Bale, Ronaldo and Ramos with a goalkeeper before every game would practice 15 to 20 minutes. We didn't like the group get any bigger than that because there'd be too much queuing, and it wasn't necessary for massive numbers to practice that skill, because ultimately you're looking at two or three players are going to step up and have that opportunity to take it in a game anyway. But multiply that by, you know, 60 games, and we were 60 games, you know, that's a good amount of practice.
It's Pep back against Madrid again. All the little swirling things about memories of 2011 and Pep the ultra Catalan against Real Madrid, and you go to Bavaria. He's subsequently said that the players convinced him to change his tactics, and he did. And I can't speak in asterisks, so he said it's the biggest fuck up of my life. Had you expected them to play the way they did? What was your tactical strategic preparation for that night in the Allianz Arena?
God, that's a good question. It was absolutely to, you know, play on the counter. That, you know, we had the 1-0 advantage. It's a slim advantage, but the fact that we were able to prevent them scoring, and you know that the away goal carries is heavy, did give us that confidence that we knew that because we stopped them, we've got the firepower to be able to score, whether that be from a set play or a counter. With the way the team were playing, the form of Ronaldo, I'm not sure, he had a lot of goals in the Champions League at that point.
He was about to break the record, all-time record. Yeah. Had lasted since 1963.
Right. So, yeah, he was in massive goal-scoring form.
Everybody seemed to be in massive physical fitness, because what I'm trying to mash together, and what I'd welcome as well, is, you know, as you're watching it from the bench, apart from the euphoria, we're in the final. It must have unrolled, unravelled differently than you expected, because as a spectacle, it was really odd. Bayern were all over the place, really quickly. As soon as it was 2-0 on aggregate, they weren't right. And yet, Ramos, Ronaldo particularly, Bale, were playing as if they thought they were 16 feet tall and could beat 20 men. That, when form, confidence, strategy, trust in your teammates comes together, it's powerful. And, you know, there was a stage at which it looked as if you could have, you know, they were not long off putting seven past Barcelona. And on that night, until there was a little bit of retrenchment, it looked as if Real Madrid were going to put seven on Bayern Munich.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's another game where they've had more of the ball, but we were just more efficient, more effective. The two set plays early on put us in a great position.
Had they been trained?
Yeah, of course. You know, we practiced set plays. We made sure we were very organised, you know, going into it. At that level, the finest detail is so important. So, you know, we were very thorough with the set play preparation. And when the second one goes in, you know, the second Ramos header, 3-0 with two away goals, you know, we're in a fantastic position there. The counter was a fabulous goal, and then rounded off with Ronaldo's free kick underneath the wall, which we spoke about in the in the pre-game talk. We had a video of Bayern's wall jumping, and you know, Cristiano's taken on board what we showed. And there's one thing taking it on board, and there's another thing executing that, because to hit a ball low, hard underneath the wall is not an easy skill to do. But it ended up being a fabulous result. And then I have a really memorable moment about when we went out into the tunnel. The tunnel at Lisbon is quite short, so you pretty much only had enough space for the two 1-11s to line up, and then there's the wall. But there was just enough space for me to be like the 12th man right at the end of the line, because I wanted to see out onto the field what was happening. And it was the end of the ceremony, and you could see the act going on the pitch, all the colours. You could just about work out that the Real fans were to this side. You could see the white, and then just there through the doorway, the red and white of Atletico, and then the trophy was sitting on the podium. And it was a real, like, hair on the back of your moment situation I was in. And I was standing right behind Cristiano, and without even realising it, it kind of took my breath.
Yeah.
And I went like that, and he just turned and looked over his shoulder and went, "Paul, don't worry," like that. And I thought, really, I'm not even playing. And he's telling me not to worry.
He's hereby got my Ballon d'Or vote next season. That is class. That is brilliant. That is wonderful.
It's a great moment. I'll never forget that.
One of the players who's out in that league, one of the players that David's Real Sociedad will have to face, is an ex-pupil of yours, somebody who I thought you changed as a footballer. I'm talking about Gareth Bale, in that I remember very well, we had a mutual friend, and he told me that Gareth needed a little bit of a G-up from you.
Mm.
Get fitter, lose some weight, cut the hair, sort himself out. Maybe take football, I don't know if it was more seriously, but that you gave him a talking to that helped him transform from a promising player at Tottenham to somebody who became one of the world greats.
Of course, absolutely, yeah.
Talk me through what you did with him.
No, I just felt, when I went there, he was, you know, he'd gone for a spell where he'd played, he'd gone like 20-odd games without being on a winning team, hadn't he? He'd never played on a winning team. It was an unbelievable record, really. Not, it wasn't his fault, but it's just the way it worked out with him. But I just found every day in training, he'd get a little knock. I can see him now limping off on one leg, and like the physio's running over to him. I always felt he was messing about with his, in them days with his hair, wetting his hair, putting the clips in. And I just said to him, like, stop messing about with your Barnet, you know, and just get on with it. And, you know, when he was injured, I said to the physios, leave him. He'll get up. Just leave him. He'll get up. Don't go running over to him. You know, if he's badly injured, he lays there long enough, different. You keep running over, and the more you do it, the more he limps off. But, no, he suddenly, I don't know, he developed, and he's just an amazing talent. I think, you know, he's up there with the best, I think, you know, in, you know, Messi, Ronaldo, Suarez. He's just behind them, you know.
Why is he?
He's got everything, I think. I mean, I was worried about him when he went to, you know, Real Madrid. I did worry about whether he would get overawed by Ronaldo and feel a little bit inferior and maybe go in his shell a little bit. But, I mean, that last season, he was excellent, wasn't he? I mean, this season hasn't... Was it the first season?
Like, the first season was underappreciated. Where you arrive late.
Yeah.
You're not fit. You're at the world's most demanding club, which I say seriously. Foreign language. You get injured early on. Carlo Ancelotti's changing the shape of the team around. He scores goals, he makes goals, he impresses Ronaldo in training, he wins Ronaldo's admiration, he gets a cup final winner, he gets a Champions League goal, and he not only copes with it, he develops. You can see that he's improved in year one. I would say year two was different, and having watched him under you at Spurs, I wondered whether the fact that he then changed and grew the hair long again meant that he felt he'd arrived, that he was the boss, he was in charge again. And I think under the second season syndrome, I think Cristiano Ronaldo looked over his shoulder and said, I've got a threat here. And I think that didn't help Gareth's development, which is presumably one of the things that you were concerned about, whether he's got the natural outgoing dominance to be able to say, I'll take you on.
Cristiano. I'll take this free kick. This is a good free kick. I'll take this. I'll do it. You know, at Tottenham, he was doing everything in the end. He was taking every free kick. And I just wonder whether he'd go, you know, go under a little bit with Ronaldo.
Do you think that about shyness as a personality?
He's a quiet boy, isn't he? You know, I mean, he's not a... I don't know even how he's settled, really, in Spain. I mean, does he speak the language yet, or...?
No, I think most people go abroad. I think he's got a smattering of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's been fortunate that Ancelotti and Paul Clement spoke English. He's now got a manager in Rafa Benitez, who is the most British Spaniard there's ever been.
Yeah.
So I think he's coping on that side. And I was an admirer of him, and I admired him coming out and saying, at this club, I want to win the Ballon d'Or. I want to become the number one player in the world. Because I think you have to show that kind of cojones. I'm saying that I believe you helped with your man.
Not at first, no. He was very young, Graham. He was only a very young boy. He was, you know, very, very young. And he'd come from Southampton with a big reputation. And, you know, as I say, was in and out the team at Tottenham and really didn't get a run. And people say, well, you switched him from left back to... But I'll be honest, I think if he'd have stayed at left back, he'd have been the best left back in the world. He was a fantastic left back. He could have been a fantastic left back, but he went on to be a fantastic left winger and wherever he plays now when he's freed off. But he would have been a fantastic left back.
Why were you in favour of altering what he did for the team, where he played? Was it just naturally you thought that there were goals coming? What was the decision-making process?
Well, I just felt he had that ability to go by people, to shoot, to score goals, and I just felt, let's get him up the park higher. And it suited him, you know, and then we end up freeing him off. In fact, but the crowd used to sing to me away from home. A lot of the Tottenham fans weren't happy when I started freeing him off in playing like he has. They used to sing his Gareth Bale, he plays on the left, because I'd played him off the right or I'd play through the middle. We went to Norwich and I played him inside in a pocket off the front, and he was fantastic, scored, right, caused... But then as soon as we went behind somewhere, or they would start singing his Gareth Bale, he plays on the left. You know, people then were suddenly marking him, trying to... Every team we played against, he was their main man. When he played well, Tottenham won. So, you know, I just felt sticking him out, keeping him wide, people would, you know, they would get a dog to mark him, and it's very difficult at times to get in the game when you're stuck out on that touchline. I like to free him off and let, you know, wherever he picked the ball up, he could go and run with it. Certainly coming off the line in them little pockets. But
Benitez has expressed it as that if Real Madrid can catch another team, rob the ball from another team, Gareth's running at space, then he's got no equals, because Ronaldo no longer makes those long 50-metre runs going past people. He's changing his 31, nearly maybe 32 in February. Yeah. But Gareth can do that better than anybody else in the world. What was always asked about him when he came to Spain was whether he had the close control technique or not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, great technique, yeah. I didn't think there was anything missing in his game, just his personality and his character, whether he could really come out in himself and put all that ability into practice, really. There was no doubt in his ability, in my opinion. And, I mean, Benitez should know him better than anybody. Rafa was he absolutely destroyed Macon, didn't he? And then, you know, we beat Inter Milan at home. I'll never forget that night, because I felt they would double up on Gareth that night, and they didn't. They left Macon at right back with no one in front of him again, and Gareth just absolutely destroyed him.
But for somebody as strategic and tactically detailed as
as Rafa, that came as a big shock.
Yeah, I thought they would stick someone in front of Macon and sit him on his toes and just double up on Gareth all night. But we end up with two against one down that side. And every time we got the ball to Gareth, he just ran at him and just destroyed him again.
Is that one of the most extraordinary ties that you've been involved in as a player?
Well, the first one was, yeah, when we beat, you know, when we went out there and we were 4-0 down, we had the keeper sent off early. And at half-time, it looked like it was going to be 10. I remember Tim Sherwood saying to me, come in, Tim was there and he was on about taking Gareth off and saying, like, shut up, shop. And I said, listen, we're going to have a go. Let's have a go at him, see if we can get a goal, couple of goals back. All right, we don't win the game, but we're going to have a go. And I left Gareth on. We got back to 4-3, another 10 minutes, so we wouldn't have got beat. They was absolutely gone.
So San Siro,
yeah,
10 men, not a particularly experienced European Spurs side in terms of winning your Spurs and knowing what... And you go to 4-3, and if the game's been longer, you're maybe going to win it there and then.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
And therefore, the way in which they faced up the second leg at White Hart Lane, you know, was asking to be beaten.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought they left themselves wide open, really, leaving Macon again to try to deal with Gareth one against one, having got such a chasing. And Macon really never recovered from that. He went from being the best right-back in the world, as he was supposed to be, to really, sadly, his career took a big dip.
Were you aware of Inter Milan's shock that night after the second leg around the club, the officials, the players that haven't been ripped to shreds by your team?
Well, in the home game, we went over there first, yeah. Well, I think they was hanging on. I mean, they were surprised how we came back second half, obviously, and then they've got to come to White Hart Lane, you know, for the second game. Yeah, you know, I thought they would really, as I say, do a job on Gareth because single-handedly almost, he'd run them ragged that night, you know. And I thought they would definitely, that would be their plan, would be to stop him. But they didn't really have a plan to stop him. They let him play, which was amazing.
And before you give me a slap round the head, I'll move off the lads and onto Rooney, because it's my contention that he's underappreciated, that people don't understand what an extraordinary talent England have had. And I find that bewildering. But I think, I don't know, but I think you're quite close. I think you feel the same, well, you know much better than me, but you feel the same as me, that this is a much better player than England has appreciated, a much better player maybe even than United fans appreciate.
Yeah, but definitely. I can't speak highly enough of him because I know how good he is. And I do feel he's underrated, definitely, because his record's there. You know, he's broke the all-time England goal-scoring record. He's going to break the Manchester United one. If you look at his career, he's, you know, he's had seasons where they've been fantastic. But he's the ultimate team player, which is ultimately will be detrimental to his goal-scoring records and to some of his performances, because he worked so hard off the ball and he played so much on the left wing, for example, and sacrificed so much for the team.
Particularly in that Ronaldo season, when Ronaldo's goal record went off the scale and he hadn't wanted to stay. That was the season when, in his words, he should have been at Real Madrid. Alec phoned him and said, don't go, and he went, okay. He phoned Ramon Calderon, didn't go. And Wayne set up goal after goal after goal from the left, didn't he?
Exactly. If you look at his assists and goals and work rate and output in matches, it's off the scale. You know, people look at how long he's played for and how many games he's played, but if you looked at the data as well in terms of his intensity outputs in the matches, they're through the roof. He's, you know, he's a physical phenomenon that doesn't get the respect I think he deserves, and rightly so. I think Wayne was quick to realise that Ronaldo was on this goal-scoring unbelievable run, and ultimately he would maybe have to do more defensive work for the team to win. And he did that because he's a team player. But the most important thing for Wayne was to become a champion to win as a team, to win the Champions League, to win league titles, because it was hit home at Manchester United that great players are looked back on because they win. And that was always hit home, whether that was because to take away the individual or to not. The biggest thing was, when you look back on it, it's not how much money you've earned, how many goals scored, it's how many things you've won. And that was hit home because Alex Ferguson used Ryan Giggs as the example of being the greatest Manchester United player because of how many trophies he'd won.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What did you think of Larsen, apart from the obvious and the goals?
I thought it was all right, aye. No, it was the best I've ever seen.
I asked because I was leaving to go to London 2 weeks after he signed, or 3 weeks after he signed. So we interviewed him, and I didn't really see him again until he moved to Barcelona. So I didn't live in Scotland for all the time that he was King of Kings. And I was shocked that he took the Camp Nou by storm. And yeah, even in the days of Ronaldinho, whatever, when he left the Barcelona pitch as a, coming off as a substitute, when he came on as a substitute, nobody, Eto'o, Rivaldo when I'd been there, Ronaldinho, nobody got a throatier, bigger roar of not just "you're good, we love you, we believe in you." Henrik Larsson played a bit part at Barcelona. The level of affection for him was just out of. And I'm asking about.
It was a horrible that day he left. I think it was Dundee United, the last game. And they done the lap of honour, projectile tears. I remember it just. See that wee,
I've never heard that expression.
See that wee emoji, wee emoticon guy that you type when you're laughing, the wee yellow guy with the blue tears. Yeah. Like that, except for no laughter. It was brutal. It was a deep sense of loss about that day, that his last game.
It is physically and emotionally painful when you lose somebody that important to you from a football club.
He could have played anywhere. I don't think anybody was. No Celtic fan was surprised when Larsson went on to have a pivotal performance, came off the bench in the Champions League, and he set up Belletti, didn't he?
At Paris, yeah.
Even was Henri came out at the end and said, he played for Arsenal in the final, obviously, but he said, "Tonight I never seen Ronaldinho, I never seen Deco, I never seen Eto'o. I only seen one man make a difference, and that was Henrik Larsson." An iconic figure, and because he could have went to any club, but he stayed with us for 7 years, and you're never going to see that again. A guy is going to come to Celtic and play even one season anywhere near the level of Henrik Larsson, he'll be off to fucking West Brom or somewhere like that.
Because of the money?
Because of the money, aye. But Larsson could, I'd imagine he was still getting weighed. Celtic could have paid a lot higher back then, but.
But they also incentivised him to stay.
He could easily have moved on.
They put a golden goodbye at the end of the contract, which is why he stayed, and it was very, it was lucrative for him to stay, but.
Don't say that, Graham.
Now you're through your pain.
Don't you hear that?
No, seriously, now you're through your pain.
No, but I'd like to think.
Should he have left earlier? Right, I'm asking you
for his own
football,
Kevin.
No, not on Henrik Larsson's behalf. You've got a football appreciation and brain and appetite that's beyond being a Celtic fan. Van Bronckhorst was always telling him, not just come here, come here, come here. Go, you should be somewhere else. What, retrospectively, how do you still think you made the right choice?
When you look at that Seville year when we got to the final against Porto, Larsson's performance that night.
Off the scale, isn't it?
So his ambitions, I don't think anybody can question that. You should move on. Fair enough, people will be saying that to him because he could have played for any club. But I think he had a vision for Celtic that obviously the people that could make that happen never had. For Martin O'Neill and Henrik Larsson and that squad, I think Seville should have been a starting point. Mm-hmm. We could have really built on that team. That's probably the closest my age group will ever see to what could have been. The Porto team won the Champions League the following year.
They did. Very little retouches.
The Liverpool team, we beat 2-0 at Anfield, they won the Champions League 2 years after with very little touches as well. Mm-hmm. So I think Larsson was right to stay because great things could have been achieved at Celtic.
It's a brilliant answer. That's what I was asking you, not just from a Celtic fan's point of view.
I don't think it's a case of that these days should somebody, maybe it's different because the Scottish football financially has regressed to the extremes that the Premiership has progressed. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I think Larsson should have at least been, I don't know, quarter-final, something, Champions League, we could have been, who knows. But it was great that night to see him. I remember having a gig at the stand and leaving to find out what the final score had been, and somebody had said Larsson had changed the game. I remember being as happy as I'd ever been.
It was an extraordinary game. They were being outplayed by 10 men. I was there, and Iniesta changed the game to a certain degree as well. But the two things I would say is that clearly Larsson made that touch for the first goal. That touch on Iniesta's pass that Eto'o runs onto. But what happened definitely throughout the course of that was his second season and it was his last game. Players, you've been at enough games now where you see other players saying, he's on the pitch now. We're okay. We're in good hands. Might or might not win it alone today, but something's changed. And the Barcelona players felt like that about him.
I used to go to the games, just be sitting, and no matter what was happening or who you were playing, you're still just going to Henrik's on. It'll be all right. It's like being out with your mental pal. Nobody's going to start with you.
Can you imagine what it was like for him, though? Because all the time you watched him, it was like, if Henrik ran, you gave him the ball. If anybody moved, he wanted it there, you gave him the ball.
But he was never greedy. I remember Harold Brattpack's debut, Celtic Kilmarnock. I think it was four. I think Brattpack scored the four goals, but he had a howler. He was the only guy I've ever seen have a four-goal howler. Like Larson made, I think, pretty much one of them he even stopped on
the
line.
Would you fly with him now? I believe he's a qualified airline pilot now, Harold.
Is that right?
He is, yeah. Would you fly with him?
I don't
based
know
on what you saw that day.
Harold,
that's what I felt you were saying.
He looks like a pilot.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I wasn't a bit of the pilot about him.
Aye. Okay.
That day, no disrespect to Harold, but Larson was never a selfish player. He was always...
But what am I? I wasn't
whatever the best
that.
Option was.
But that's right, because he was a team leader.
His decision-making, for example.
So, if you're that good and you win trophies and you win matches based on your decision-making and the team is subservient to you for the right reasons because you do the right things, you resolve problems, and then you go to Barcelona and the system says, the system that you've seen and you understand now, no, you get the ball when we've moved the other team around enough or when Xavi dictates. Because when he came, I'm not bright enough to know that it was automatically giving me a assist. But he didn't understand the system. He went, hold on, I'm in at last, and I've just made a brilliant run. It was the right ball to give it to me in Xavi or Iniesta, or maybe it was Edmilson. Then was, no, that's not how it works. And Eto also, who's an irascible character, wouldn't give the ball to him. What I learned, what he taught me, Larson, was that he just, when he broke his leg in the Clásico in November, he went away and just relearned. At what age? I don't know what age he was, 32 or 31.
I still have that sense of humility to go back.
And the capability to go, I'll just reboot.
Yep.
So I guess it doesn't surprise you, but you know what? You've seen the Barcelona system.
It's quite a unique career model when you look at even going back to Feyenoord, having the fallout there, moving to Scotland.
Midfielder at Feyenoord.
For that kind of 600,000, and then suddenly this team in Scotland, as I'm sure that's Celtic were seen as in his circles, whatever, just he's moving to the Scottish League, it's a backward step. To then go on to get to that level, mm-hmm. that you leave and go to Barcelona and then win the Champions League. And then obviously Man United as well.
Seville was his biggest disappointment, but I'm asking you a little bit about that experience.
Also, just to go back to Henrik Larsson, I'm probably the only guy that's got his autograph on a first bus all-day ticket. There we go.
Queuing up the car park.
We're up to collect tickets. One day me and my mate Tony dogged the last two periods of school on a Friday. Went up and the team were just leaving, like they'd trained at Celtic Park that day. So we're sort of hanging about and we've seen a bit of commotion. It was Larson, so the two sprinted right up. But we never had pens or you never had smartphones at the time. All I had was my first bus all day ticket, Clyde Bank to Parkhead. So I was going, you know the way they just grab one pen and just sign everybody's autograph with the same pen. I'd handed it the all day ticket and he sort of looked at me because he had a marker pen. And a first bus all day ticket's pretty narrow, so he's... He had to lean on his jeans, but they were light blue jeans and a tiny bit of the ink went off the all-day ticket and onto his blue jeans. I remember I was stomach churning. I was like, Henrik, I'm so sorry. As if like, I'm ready to offer, like, I'll go to D2 and I'll buy you a new pair of jeans.
Can you afford a new pair? Because I'll find the money somehow, H. Don't worry about
it. He looked at me and he was more, this wee guy took this pretty bad because I was quite a nervous wee guy. And he goes like, it's okay. And he gave me my all-day ticket, so we're trying to get back on the bus. But Larson had obscured the date. So the driver's not letting us on. And my three pals, Tony and the other two, they're going, it's Henrik Larson's autograph, mate. As if, like, you need to let him on. And the driver's going, Larson, he's shite, I'm a Rangers man. So we're going, mate, come on. He was only obviously having a joke and he waved us on. But
only in Glasgow.
It was the way my pals rounded round me, as if it should have been...
Are you serious? Come on.
As if that's valid for
a
week.
What are you talking about? We should be able to drive it home. Let Kevin in the driver's seat, man.
It's a
joking.
Pass, man. So I've still got it somewhere.
At that stage in the Scottish education system, you could get out of school at about 15, couldn't you?
Yeah. I have a birthday right at the turn of New Year on 30th of December, so I'm in between that awkward time. But anyway... The Celtic players used to come in and get some citrons and things, and then eventually I trained two nights a week. And then eventually I was asked within 4 months by Billy McNeil, who was just taken over from Jock, to come in and do a 2-week trial. So Eddie Coakley, my boss, had said, get in there.
Yeah.
We'll give you the 2 weeks off, on you go. So on the second day I was there, Danny McGrain came in and I was like a bit shaky with Danny.
Understandably.
And he says, Where do you come from? I said, oh, Maryhill Barracks. He said, I pass by there every morning. How do you get in? And I said, oh, I get the bus, I get the 61, and then I walk around the back, I can jump off, get the 64. He said, well, if I'm going by at such and such, is that too late for you to come in? Now, I later joined the ground staff, but I wasn't on the ground staff for that 2 weeks, although I did a little bit of work after training. So Danny used to bring me in, which I remember waiting, thinking, he'll forget. that I'm here. I'm sitting outside this wee pub called The Politician, which is right obviously at the barracks entrance. And all my mates are going by and they're, you know, all right, wee man, what are you waiting on? Who are you waiting on? I'm like,
how'd you say
Danny McGroom. What? And sure enough, Danny turns up.
Fantastic.
In you come. And he picked me up every day I was there. So ever since that, Danny always picked me up. And then there was one time Danny took me back to his house with a bit of lunch and he showed me some footage of Dalglish and him. Mm. Oh, I just thought it was the most brilliantest thing. I remember sitting there at night trying to work out, why did he show me that? There must be a reason he showed me that. So I don't like keeping too many things in. I like to get it out. So I asked him the next day, why the hell did you show me that? And he says, because I think you're ready for it. Now, I didn't know later on, but David Proven, my great pilots guy, later tells me that when Celtic were struggling, getting bad results, and I was in the reserve team, they were having team meetings and Billy McNeil was saying to George McCluskey in front of me, it's not good enough. And he would say to Danny, his team captain, what have you got to say? He said, the solution is next door. He's staring you in the face. Whoa. And I don't know why you don't get him in. And I wasn't aware of this, but this went on for, by all accounts, 4 or 5 months. So Danny became my kind of guru. And whenever I had anything to ask, he was protocol.
Full of experience, level-headed, Celtic tuned through, and unbeknownst to you, saying to the manager, a legend himself,
yeah. Play how the hell fella. He never left Celtic, because everybody wanted him.
Yeah.
Diabetes, fractured skull, broken shin. I watched him coming back from the broken ankle and played Rangers reserves. John McDonald's an up-and-coming star at Rangers, and they beat us 7-1. Me and my boys in the ground staff, we were all Danny McGrain fanatics. And the palms of our hands were all sweating, worrying about him. And within 3 months, he was back in the team, back to his brilliant best. He was the most remarkable individual.
Have I described it correctly? Because I'm describing my growing up memories of him, that it was about his tackling, his judgment, his reading of situations. It felt to me, you know, principally I admired him more for Scotland than for Celtic, but it felt like he was one of these defenders who could change the tone or tempo of a game, because he'd break up what seemed to be floods of attacks, take it, give it to somebody, and suddenly, you know, a 10-second gap might become a 30-second gap when you're on the attack, and if you were being flooded before, then it stopped. He seemed to be an enormous football man beyond... He wouldn't even classify him as a fullback. No. He seemed to be more to him
He was far more than that. He was very much an all-rounder. Even when he got older, he eventually had Davey Proben, who was a great working winger, great crosser of the ball. Davey supplied a lot of goals for me. But Davey all liked to do his shift coming back, and it was quite unusual to get that. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was flicks.
I do the clever things.
Yeah, and one-twos. And,
yeah.
But Davey did the other side, the hard yards, as we called it. So he was brilliant for Danny and that, but they two never really always got on. They would fall out all the time. Danny would say, yeah, you've done really well, but he'd fall out with you just as quick. So, you know, it was a reality of standard of where he played. And at Scotland, at one stage, he was the best left-back we had. And every other right-back only got in because he could play left-back. So he was the most amazing character, Danny. And to still be floating about, for me, is something to achieve. But I just find that there's certain glows. You know, like we all want to meet heroes. I remember listening to Ken Dalglish's first ever voice interview. I thought, that doesn't sound like my hero. It just sounded weird. Lots of big-name people that I've met in my life. John McEnroe, who I loved as a sportsman. But standing up in those, and then you meet really greats, the Beckenbauers and all these type of people. Cruyffs. But Danny McGrain is right up there with anybody I've ever met.
Following in the footsteps of the great John Charles, who you've already mentioned, maybe the biggest success of a British footballer abroad, I don't know, still regarded as one of Serie A's all-time greats.
I never realised. John Charles would be one of the biggest foreign successes from any country. He was unbelievable, the position he held, and not just the Juventus fans, but in Italian football. I remember watching the TV one night, and there was a film, and it was him and Savori, and they were in the dressing room, and it was really mind-boggling where he stands. Unbelievable. And say, for example, the Gazzetta dello Sport or something like that, every so often, say Juventus were playing Inter, and then we'd take a famous game in the 60s, they would show the article of it, and the teams, and John had done this, Safari had done that, the two of them had done that. He was unbelievable.
The gentle giant, a brilliant Welshman, played in a World Cup, at least one anyway. I think we're not going to have time to do him justice now, but another forgotten
great football, what he did
for British football. I mean, he went there and over a span. He went to Rome, but his time at Juventus and that team was phenomenal. He was as big a name there as anybody. That's how he is. I'm not just throwing it away. That's the impression I get from talking to journalists who watched him play, players, supporters. John Charles was immense.
How much do you get in life that's completely free, reliable, regular, good for your sex life, and free? Yeah, the big interview. All of these, in their full form, and many more, are available if you search for The Big Interview on Acast, that's A-C-A-S-T, iTunes, or usually wherever you get your podcasts. The Big Interview was the idea of Backpage, and it's produced by them. Thanks to Beer Jacket for the music. Keep up to date with everything that we're doing at grahamhunter.tv, where there's a little box where you fill in your email address. And if you sign up there, you'll get our newsletter, which includes the opportunity to put your questions to our guests. We're on Facebook, search for The Big Interview, and GH Podcast on Twitter, plus Instagram. Keep in touch. Let us know what you think. More soon, baby.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.